Recorded live.
Good evening, children of Israel. Pastor Eli James here, along with Pastor William Fink. We're going to have a historical discussion this evening before we move on to the book of Ephesians next Saturday night. We want to discuss the origin of the Gaels and Scots in Israel. Okay, we know for a fact that the Irish, Brits, otherwise known as Gaels, and also Scots, are definitely descended from the 12 tribes of Israel. Specifically, we're going to point out from Zerah, Judah, probably from Dan, and also Gad. There's simply no doubt that the Gadites also settled in Britain. And tonight we're going to be discussing the migrations from Scythia through Egypt to northern Spain called Galicia or Galicia or Calicia. And that's actually where the name Gael comes from, is that Gaelic word Calicia, and which can also be traced back to ancient Israel in the words Gilead and also Golan. The word Golan in Hebrew means exile or wanderer, and it's exactly what these people were. They exiled away from Israel and wound up in Ireland and Scotland, okay, and that's where the Gaelic people actually come from. And we'll trace the migration of Miles and Phineas. Apparently Phineas is the original founder of this dynasty. And Miles and Scotta carried it through to Spain, and then, as the story goes, they were prepared to invade Ireland from northern Spain, but Miles died, and Scotta picked up the assault with her six sons and two other sons Miles had from a previous marriage, and they invaded Ireland. That's the legendary story, and I'm going to pick it up in the book of Isaiah, chapter 11. Verses 11 through, let's say, 14 here. And it shall come to pass in that day that Adonai shall set his hand again, the second time, to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, which we can call Scythia for our purposes today, and from Egypt, from Tapanhes, which was where Scotta and Tiatefi migrated with the prophet Jeremiah, and from Pathos, and from Cush, and from Elam, and from Shinar, and from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. Okay, the islands of the sea we interpret as being the British Isles, including Ireland. So far, so good, Bill?
Well, I would interpret the islands of the sea to being all the islands of the Mediterranean and Europe all the way to Britain.
Okay, yes, yeah. So
there were Israelites spread. I mean, it's demonstrable that from Scripture, that there were Israelites spread from Cyprus all the way to Britain.
Yes, very good, very good. So basically, tonight's discussion is going to be about the Mediterranean migration, okay? But let me finish these, and I'll elaborate on what I judge to be the three major waves of the migrations of Israelites to the west, okay? Verse 12, "And he shall set up an ensign for the nations, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel, and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." So again, as I mentioned in the very brief intro, that Zerah Judah is involved, and Israelites from Scythia are involved here, okay? Verse 13, "The envy also of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not vex Ephraim." And this follows the prophecy in Ezekiel, where the two houses, Israel and Judah, will one day be merged back together and live in peace. If you consider the European wars we've had, we haven't quite established that total peace yet. Verse 14, "But they shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west, and they shall spoil them of the east together, and they shall lay their hand upon Edom and Moab, and the children of Ammon shall obey them." Okay, so we're talking flying upon the shoulders of the Philistines. Is this translation?
The Septuagint has flying upon the ships of the Philistines.
the ships of the Philistines.
And the Philistines were, they were Adamic. And
yes.
The Bible can prove that the Philistines were Adamic.
Okay.
The Philistim came from Mitzrayim. They were
right.
Ham. And in the prophets, I think it's in Zechariah, Yahweh promises that a bastard shall live in Ashdod.
Okay.
And Ashdod was one of the chief Philistine cities. That tells me that at the time the prophecy was uttered, that bastards did not live in Ashdod.
Right.
Okay, that's what that tells me.
That's an exception,
let,
right?
Let me say that Goliath was not a Philistine.
Okay.
Goliath, and this is
right.
proven from the Book of Chronicles, that Goliath was actually one of the sons and his brothers, because he had brothers that were slain by Israelites
mm-hmm.
later. That they were of the sons of Rapha. Rapha means the giant.
Right.
They were of the sons of the giants.
Yes.
And we're told about the valley of the Kenites and how they had chariots of iron, and the children of Israel couldn't destroy them, and they were like giants.
Yes.
And this description is given during the invasions into the land of Canaan by Joshua, and Goliath is a direct connection there.
Yes,
he was a Rephaim Kenite giant fighting as a mercenary for the Philistines.
Yes, okay. Before we continue here, Mark is putting our websites up, and we tend to forget to announce our websites. And mine is anglo-saxonisrael.com and Bill's is christoguinea.org. And you will find plenty of material about the migrations of our people from Israel into Europe and, you know, points west and, you know, actually spreading all over the earth, as these verses we just read indicate, okay? And then Commander McBragg says, I have a drawing of an Egyptian artwork depicting Phoenicians as giant white men with black hair. So the Hamites that these Philistines descended from were most definitely white men, actually descended from Noah.
Let me say that somebody might interpret that as the Egyptians depicting Phoenicians.
Okay.
All right? But the word Phoenician is not found in any ancient writing.
Okay.
I don't care if it's Egyptian, Babylonian,
right.
Assyrian, Hittite. It's not found in any ancient writing until the Greeks started writing.
Okay.
Okay? And that's like 700 B.C.
Okay.
Okay?
Very good.
So they might see an Egyptian drawing depicting an inhabitant of the land later called Phoenicia
mm-hmm.
by the Greeks, but that don't make that person a Phoenician.
Right, right.
The Egyptians may have drawn pictures of the inhabitants of New Mexico, and they look Chinese, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that don't make them Americans, you know?
Right. Now, is there a relationship here now between the Philistines, which were much earlier, and the later Phoenicians?
Well, there's no doubt that it's possible that some of the Philistines may have been mistaken for Phoenicians.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they were, the Israelites in large part did move into a lot of Philistine cities or cities considered Philistine.
Right.
And that is evident both in the Bible and in archaeology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to quickly move to a website. www.irishstoryteller.com/mylesion.html. I'm going to enlarge this really quickly here. And I'm going to start reading. The story of the Milesians begins in the faraway land of Scythia. Bill, you want to tell people exactly where Scythia was? Because I think in this instance we're talking about Greater Scythia. The southern portion of Scythia today would be called Armenia.
Well, let me explain the Milesians.
Okay.
Okay. Miletus is a great city, Greek. It's considered Greek, but the inhabitants are Phoenician.
Okay.
Okay. They are originally called by the Greeks Carians. It's the southwesternmost district of Anatolia, or what we know today as Turkey.
Right.
Okay, which was all Greek and Trojan and Lydian, and it was all absolutely white at one time.
Yeah, and they were all descendants of the Israelites and some Japhethites.
Well, yes, Israelites and Japhethites mixed.
Yeah.
Now the Carians were said by the earliest Greek writers to have come to Anatolia by sea.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And they were identified with the Phoenicians.
Okay.
And the Trojan princes, the Carians, the Cilicians, and other of the Phoenician settlements in Anatolia and Greece, they took their kings, and Thessaly was settled by Phoenicians in large numbers, Thessaly in Greece.
Yes, okay.
And they took their kings from Trojan princes.
Yes.
According to Strabo, and that would be the fulfillment, once it's realized that the Trojan princes descended from Zerah Judah, of Judah Scepter,
right,
in the dispersion.
Yes, yes.
Now Miletus, the only connection I could put with the Milesians and the Scythians is this. The Milesians had many colonies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? They were Phoenicians that departed from Israel long before the Assyrian deportations.
Right.
Long before there were actual Scythians.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are no actual Scythians until after the Assyrian deportations and until after the children of Israel start to depart from Assyria and migrate north into,
right,
into Eastern Europe.
Yes.
Now, however, the Milesians, and they're noted, this is noted by Strabo, by Diodorus Siculus, by many of the Greek writers, they had many colonies around the Black Sea and along the Danube River Valley.
Yes.
And those areas would be considered Scythia.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
So if these were Milesians who had left for some reason the Black Sea or Danube River areas to travel west, well, that makes sense. But that's the only Scythian connection that makes sense.
Well, we know the Galatians that we talked about, had a whole series on that just ended last week, were in fact these Gauls who had come back from the Danube River area and back into a similar story.
Well, the Scythians came into, they went up to the children of Israel as they migrated up through the Caucasus Mountains, came around the Black Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And coming around the Black Sea, they came down into the region of the Danube River Valley in Thrace. And the migrations from beyond the Black Sea into the Danube River Valley in Thrace by Scythians is very well recorded in the Greek writers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay.
Now, the Greeks later called these people, initially they were called Sakka and Scythians.
Mm-hmm.
And by the 4th century, the Greeks were calling these people Galatai.
Right. Okay.
Okay? Now, I believe that's because they poked fun at them for several centuries since the days of Homer as being, as living on milk.
Okay.
and the Greek word Galus is milk.
Uh-huh.
And Galatus means of milk.
Right. Well, they were cattle drivers, too.
Well, right, they were. They were cattle drivers and herders.
Yes.
Now, and they were renowned for that among the Greeks.
Right.
Now, the as being pastoral people.
Right, right.
And okay, always on the move. Now the Galatahi, they had made raids across the Danube into Greek lands. I mean, this was a constant problem for the Greeks, probably from about 400 B.C. or so, all the way, into Roman times.
Right.
But around 220, 230, and I'm taking this off the top of my head, so if I'm 10 or 20 years off, don't fault me. Around 220, 230 B.C., a Brennus, who was a Galatahi chieftain, crossed the Danube with a rather large group of Gaulish or Scythian men, women, and children, and they raided Greece, and they raided Greece, and they crossed the Bosphorus, they crossed into Anatolia, and they fought with the that they actually sacked a lot of Greek temples, and they fought with the king of Pergamos.
Okay.
And the king of Pergamos was Attalus, and he was an extremely powerful king at the time, and Attalus had actually defeated the Galatahi, but not decisively. But he defeated them badly enough to get them to agree to a truce, and he gave them to settle in the land of ancient Phrygia.
Okay.
Now let me say this. Phrygia is renowned. Phrygia was a colony of Thrace. It's in central Anatolia, closer to central Anatolia.
Okay.
It's off the coast towards the Black Sea region. And Phrygia was actually destroyed by the Cimmerians.
Okay.
By the Cimmerians.
Other Israelites. Yes.
Well, no, which are the ancestors of the Galatians.
Right.
They're the ancestors of the same Gauls.
Right.
That came back and dwelt there 400 years later.
Right, right. Another example of our kinsmen fighting each other over territory, right?
Right. Right, and the Phrygians are most likely Japhethites descended from the Thracians.
Yeah. So the presence of our people at various points in history in Anatolia, what today known as Turkey, is undeniable, okay? But the vast majority of historians don't consider those people to be Israelites. They typically credit them with being what Amorites and what have you. You know, they give them all different kinds of names. Because they're obviously Aryan people.
And they're not Jews.
And they're not Jews. Okay.
They look for the people in the Near East, knowing these people came from the Near East, they look for the people in the Near East, and L.A. Waddell is the premier example of this.
Yeah.
And they find the people who were contrary to the Jews, and that's the labels they give them.
Right, right. So mixing up the Jews with the Hebrews.
With Israel, right.
Right, and with Israel, they look for people that don't have hooked noses and receding foreheads.
Well, basically, that's true.
Yeah.
And that they, you know, thousands of blonde bodies and remains of Caucasians have been found in Palestine.
Right.
And they've all been labeled as Amorite.
Right.
And they're really the true Hebrew Israelites.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, so the period, we've established the presence of the Israelites throughout the Mediterranean basin in Turkey, obviously Armenia, Mesopotamia, and obviously, of course, Israel and Philistia and Phoenicia. Okay, there's no doubt that our people inhabited those areas in great, great numbers. Okay, now let's go back to what the historians call the Greater Scythia, which is the area you just described, and we're talking here. Probably around 600 B.C. or thereabouts, okay? The story of the Milesians begins in the faraway land of Scythia, and which we were just talking, and you just pointed out that this Galatia is actually the area we're talking about. Gato, grandson of the king of Scythia, was bitten by a poisonous serpent. His father, Nuil, N-U-I-L, a younger son of the king, carried the boy to the Israelites, where he asked for the aid of their leader, Moses. The man, and this is not the, I don't know if it's the same Moses or this is later, but here, let me just continue reading. The man of God prayed over the child and touched him with his rod. The boy rose up healed. Moses told the boy that his descendants would go to a land in which no poisonous serpents would live. It would be an island which would be found in the track of the setting sun. Okay, so far west. The journey to Innisfail, the island of destiny, took three generations. A banner to honor Gato was made with the dead serpent mounted on a staff, representing the one used by Moses to heal the boy. Milesius, now we're in the 600 B.C. area, Milesius carried it with him on the search for the promised island. He traveled to Spain, tarried there to rule as king. So according to this legend, the Milesians, or Gaels, as we know them today, were following this prophecy made by Moses, okay? It was the explorer Ith, I-T-H, who first saw the island. He was brother to Milesius. Certain it was Innisfail, he landed to explore the island. The Tuatha de Danans, people who resided on the island, were suspicious of the strangers. Ith was mortally wounded. His followers carried him to his ship and sailed toward Spain and his family. He died at sea. His son, Lugaid, or Louis, or Leary, depending on how you pronounce it, returned to the clan asking them to avenge his father's death and conquer the island. Milesius had died while Ith was away on the journey. His sons decided there was no more reason to stay in Spain. They headed toward the island with their cousin guiding them. At their head was their widowed mother, Scadia. The Milesians had so much difficulty locating the island, they perceived the Tuatha de Danans had rendered it invisible by means of sorcery. At length, they sighted the island and beheld the first sight of Innisfail, with its green mountains and inviting bays. They dropped anchor and prepared to go ashore the following day, but when they rose up the next morning, they could only see a low ridge of land. More tricks claimed the Milesians. Nevertheless, they reached shore. They approached the Dardanans with spears and shields in hand. Battle ensued, and led by Skada, let me just drop down here, Skada had entered the battle carrying the battle flag of their ancestor and was killed. She was buried beneath the royal cairn at Glen Scoene. There was a short, fierce battle at Caelton in Meath, and that decided the fate of the island. The Tuatha De Danans lost their kingdom and land. Their three kings were dead, and, of course, the Milesians took over. So this is the basic, you know, in rough sketch, the legend of how from Scythia to Spain, otherwise known as Cilicia, these people finally wind up in Ireland. Okay. Now, what is there anything from your study of Greek history and related history that parallels any of this so far?
Well, no. And okay. First, let me. I'd like to say a couple of things. First,
okay.
Yeah, you know, the poems that you're citing were probably finally written down around the 10th century,
yeah,
AD. And that's not really a problem. The problem is that while the core of the story may be true, we don't know how much of it was embellished over hundreds of years by
sure.
bards.
Sure.
Now the Greeks knew very little about Ireland. And first let me say why. Because the Carthaginians had the Western Mediterranean locked down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The Greeks did not know anything about life beyond the Pillars of Hercules.
Uh-huh.
And did very little sailing because if you got caught in a ship in the Western Mediterranean by the Phoenician navies,
yes.
you were slaves.
Right.
You were a slave and your ship was theirs. They had the whole Western Mediterranean locked down.
Mm-hmm.
Until the Punic Wars with the Romans and their defeat
right.
by the Romans.
Right, right. And it was the Phoenicians, otherwise known as the Punics, who invented the legend that if you sail beyond the Pillars of Hercules, you'll fall off the edge of the earth.
Well, yeah, they told them all kinds of things.
Right.
But they basically had it militarily, navally, you know, they had it locked down. It was theirs.
Yes.
And they controlled all the traffic between the Western Mediterranean and the East. And they control all the traffic between Iberia, the Iberian Peninsula, and Carthage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's get back into biblical history here. I'm going to be actually quoting from my book, The Great Impersonation, because I trace the origin of virtually every European white nation to various tribes of Israel in the first few chapters of the book. And here I'm quoting from E. Raymond Capps' Jacob's Pillar, and he's quoting from an early chronicle of Ireland known as the Plantation of Ulster, dating to 700 B.C., and records the first important settlers of Hebrews in Ireland. In one section of these records known as the Milesian, I've turned the page, Milesian Records, gives the genealogy of William the Conqueror, otherwise known as Gallum. Says Capt, among the names in the genealogy of Gallum are several that are specifically mentioned as belonging to the red or scarlet branch of Judah. Zerah was known as the Prince of the Scarlet Thread. He was one of the many pairs of important twins whose various descendants we have been tracing. In Genesis 38:26-30, and it came to pass in a time of her travail that, behold, twins were in her womb, and that's Tamar. And it came to pass when she travailed that one put out his hand, and the midwife took and bound upon his hand a scarlet thread, saying, this came out first. And it came to pass, as he drew back his hand, that, behold, his brother came out. And she said, how hast thou broken forth? This breach be upon thee. Therefore his name was called Phares. And afterward came out his brother that had a scarlet thread upon his hand, and his name was called Zerah. Okay, now it turns out that one of the major flag symbols of Ireland is a hand with a scarlet thread tied around the wrist. Okay, now how could this symbol come about unless it's actually tied to this scriptural story here? Okay, Now, continuing, the story of the descendants of Perez and Zerah is well summarized in a little booklet entitled Israel, Judah, and Judah by Arthur A. Patchkovsky. Judah had twin sons, Perez and Zerah. The royal line was split into two branches, beginning with the posterity of these two boys, and there remained two branches until about 585 B.C., when both branches were united and have been one branch since that time. He's talking about the future joining together. Anyway, this reference to the marriage in Ireland of Tiatefi, daughter of Zedekiah, a descendant of Perez, to Yochai, the Harriman chief king of Hibernia, a descendant of Zerah. Okay, so Perez was called the high branch. Through him, all the kings came from David to Zedekiah and through Christ's birth. Zerah was called the low branch. The ruler's kings over Israel as a whole would have come through one or both of these two branches. So while the Perez branch ruled in Jerusalem down to 587 B.C., the Zerah branch had migrated to Ireland and settled there somewhere about 900 B.C. So, Bill, why don't you take us through the Zerah kingship line in the Mediterranean basin, and then we'll tie the Zerahites together with the Perizzites through Jeremiah and the two daughters.
Well, there's the sons of Zerah are namely in 1 Kings chapter 4 verse 31, I believe it is, or it's right around there if it's not. Darda and Calcol.
Mm-hmm.
Are compared to Solomon in wisdom.
Okay.
And they are called the sons of Mahal, who's a son of Zerah,
mm-hmm.
the son of Judah.
Right.
And this is also evident in Chronicles. Now, and it's worded a little differently in Chronicles. Now, Darda is the legendary founder of Troy.
Okay.
And Calcol is, I equate with Calchas, the legendary founder of Pamphylia.
Mm-hmm.
Which is right next to Caria in Anatolia. It's the land between Caria and Cilicia, along the coast of what we know today as southern Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these men were great figures. Darda and Calcol are great figures in Greek poetry. And we see them we see these same names in 1 Kings chapter 4. And they're great men compared to Solomon in wisdom. But these men are great men nowhere in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right.
You know, we only find these names in the Greek writing. And can we assume that they're not the same people?
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be crazy.
Right.
I think we have to assume that they probably are the same people.
Yes.
Because it can be demonstrated that Greek culture is simply Hebrew culture moved west.
Right.
And paganized a little. It's evident to me that they are certainly the same people, especially when Darda founds this line of Trojans, which are always recognized as a royal line.
Mm-hmm.
Not only as a royal line, as the royal line.
Yes.
That all the surrounding nations, according to Strabo, took their kings from the sons of the Trojan princes.
Yes, yes, okay. Yeah. So, and we have, and then of course, the Roman emperors descended from the Trojans, right? And we also have evidence that Brutus, who was one a Trojan,
there's a very believable story of Ahenius, and it's repeated by all of the Greek writers. And I've never seen it disputed by an early writer.
Okay.
That Ahenius took a colony of Trojans after the defeat at Troy at the hands of the Danaan Greeks,
mm-hmm.
and he took a colony of Trojans to what was called at the time Alba Longa, or an area in Italy which Rome later became the chief city of.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now this is 400 years before Rome was founded, but the Trojans were there 400 years before they decided, some of their descendants, to build Rome,
mm-hmm.
to found Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Now these that there's a connection with Italy that goes further back in history, because the Etruscans claim to descend from the Lydians and claim to be colonists of Lydia, and all the Greek writers claim that of the Etruscans.
Okay.
And the Lydians are actually the Shemitic Lud of Genesis chapter 10, dwelt in Anatolia. Their chief city was Smyrna, and they were that they were allies of the Trojans against the Danites.
Okay.
So it's almost like they knew where they could go.
Right. So they're Semites, not Japhethites.
Right.
You're saying? Okay. So Rome was founded by these Shemites, of course, blood relatives of the Israelites, but not Israelites.
Well, no. Rome was founded by descendants of these Trojans who settled in Italy,
okay.
And the Etruscans were their neighbors to the north.
Ah, okay.
Okay, so what I'm saying is that if you lose a war and your allies have a colony, why don't you just go there?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Because
right.
you've just suffered this great defeat, and you probably really can't stick around without a lot of further agitation.
Right.
So I'm pretty convinced that the Ahenius story is true,
uh-huh.
because it's the circumstances that allow it are all in place.
Yes.
You know, and all of the Greek writers claim the descent of the Romans,
mm-hmm.
not just the Caesars,
right?
Of the Romans from the Trojans,
right?
Now
okay.
Caesar himself claimed that descent.
Okay.
Now a lot of people in British Israel and people in Christian identity that they'll make the claim of the Caesars, but if the Caesars descended from the Romans. I'm sorry, from the Trojans, then the entire Roman patrician class
sure.
had to descend from the Trojans.
Right, right. And we also know that Brutus was a Trojan, but he migrated further west, and he was one of the of Zara Judah that settled in Britain.
Well, there's a story that a couple of generations after the settlement in Italy,
mm-hmm.
that Brutus departed under criminal circumstances with a colony and settled in Britain.
Uh-huh.
And this story is not as well founded in literature as the story of Ahenius the Trojan settling and founding what would later become the Roman state.
Right. Right.
But it is in Virgil, and it is accepted by the later English writers.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So Nennius accepts it.
Yes, yes. Okay. So we were establishing the presence of Israelites throughout the Mediterranean basin and their migration westward, okay? And so at this point, we've gotten into the story pretty well. I might as well talk about the three waves. And the first wave would be from ancient Egypt, Israelites, as you're just describing, from Zara Judah, migrating across the Mediterranean Sea from Egypt, founding Troy. And you say Chalcol. Did you discuss Chalcol settlements?
Well, yes. Chalcol settled in Pamphylia.
Pamphylia.
He's the legendary Greek founder of Pamphylia. Pamphylia is actually named Chalcis.
Okay.
Now I would like to I have this Ireland's history in maps.
Okay.
Okay. This website it's at www.rootsweb.ancestry.com/IRLKIK/IHM.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now the this talks about and this is you know the Pleistocene age. Okay. There's a lot. I think this has to be addressed before we move on since we're
yes.
still in this early time. The Pleistocene age is the age where glaciers covered Europe.
Okay.
And there's a lot of pagans out there, and a lot of, I just think they're freaks, that believe that the white race has its origins in the northernmost extremes of Europe.
Okay.
Well, it's pretty much fully demonstrable by geologists that all of northern Europe, all of Ireland, all of what we know today as England,
mm-hmm.
was covered with glaciers until at least 11,000 B.C.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
Now, this land, by all the earliest Greek writers, is called uninhabitable because of the cold.
Right.
By Strabo calls it uninhabitable because
mm-hmm.
of the cold. He calls it barely inhabitable beyond Celtica, which is his France.
Yes.
And he says that Ireland and Britain are barely inhabitable because of the cold.
Okay.
And yeah. It seems to me that the cold was the climate was a lot colder in his time than it is today in ours.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And even Caesar's two invasions of Britain were launched in the summer.
Yes.
He waited for the warmest weather to launch.
Exactly.
Now the earliest this Ireland's History and Maths website, it has some interesting things. He gives, and this is not a Christian site, but he gives the and it's certainly not an identity site, right?
Mm-hmm.
He has these maps drawn up from all the earliest legend. He has a copy of what would probably be Ptolemy's map on it, and he says that the sons of Milesius or Miles,
mm-hmm.
and I think that this Milesius is probably seems to me to be a fictional character that the Milesians that settled in Ireland sought to find their origin in.
Okay.
Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah, okay.
And this, according to this site, that this Ireland was cut in half. It was divided in half by the sons of Milesius.
Okay.
And the lower half was called Eber's half.
Okay, right.
And the upper half, and that has to be the Hebrew half, right? Well, the upper half was called Heremon's half.
Mm-hmm.
And let me say that Heremon, it seems to me that the original meaning of the word might be an R and the Hebrew,
right.
The Hebrew word,
Ariman,
which gives us Mon or Main, and it means a mountain abode,
mm-hmm.
That Heremon means a mountain abode.
Okay.
And that's what it means. And maybe the later kings were given that as a title, just like the Parthian kings were given the title Arsaca or Arsaces, which actually means chief of the Saka.
Okay. Yes. Very good. Very good. Well, I mean, there's definitely the legends definitely agree that the origin of the Irish and the Northern Ireland, Southern Ireland, Scots, Gaels, etc., is in Israel. They definitely agree. Let me quote here to back up what you're saying here. This is from www.cai.org and Bible Studies with Scotta, one of the royal daughters. Okay, most of the legends agree in the following: the ancestor of the Milesians, Phinehas, or Phineas, lived in Scythia. His son Nel, N-E-L, participated in the building of the Tower of Babel. After the division of the nations, he became an expert in languages and was therefore invited to Egypt by Pharaoh. He married Scotta, the Pharaoh's daughter, and witnessed the drowning of Pharaoh's army in the Red Sea during the Exodus. Moses healed Nel's son Gathelos, another pronunciation, and prophesied there wouldn't be any snakes in the country, very similar to the other legend that I just quoted. They were going to go to. After some time, Breogan, one of the descendants of Nel, sails to Spain and builds the city of Brigantia there. If the ITH, the uncle for or brother of Milesius, son of Breogan, goes to Ireland, gets killed there by the Tuatha De Danann, King Milesius sends his 9 sons to avenge his death. One of them is Heremon, the husband of Tia. The Tuatha De Danann are conquered, and the Milesians settle in Ireland. So this is apparently where the split of the island takes place between the Iberians to the south and the Heremons to the north, right?
And there's a Brigantes in the south on Ptolemy's map.
Okay, Brigantes. Okay. Now, one more paragraph from this site. It is true that Scotta in all legends is declared as the daughter of Pharaoh. As already written in a previous article, did Tia Tefi ever exist? This is not necessarily an argument against her being an Israelite. On the contrary, being a former ally of the House of Judah, it seems logical that the contemporary Pharaoh Hophra take over some kind of guardianship of these royal refugees. Scotta being mentioned as the daughter of Pharaoh is actually a very strong link right back to Egypt and Tophanes, okay? Now let's go back to the scriptures from an article, Reverend John Heslip, in a booklet entitled Who and Where Are the Lost Ten Tribes? He says this, About 2 years after the Judahites were taken captive to Babylon, there arrived in Ireland from Egypt by way of Spain a sage. He brought with him a princess and his scribe or secretary. The ship that brought them to Ireland belonged to the Iberian Danann. They landed on the northeast coast of Ireland where Carrickfergus now stands. The little party brought with them a huge mysterious chest, a banner, and a large rough stone, which would be the Stone of Scone. The name of the aged seer was Alam Fadla, wonderful prophet. The princess was called Tamar Tefi, meaning palm beautiful, and the scribe's name was Brug or Baruch. This is according to the Irish records. The name Brug or Baruch is practically identical with Baruch, Jeremiah's scribe. Irish poetry is full of praises, the praises of Tamar Tefi, of her lofty birth, her stormy life in Jerusalem and at Tapanis in Egypt, her voyage to Spain and thence to Ireland. So according to this legend, apparently Tia Tefi or Tamar Tefi survived and settled in Northern Ireland, but Skada died in the attempt. Okay, so now it's possible that Tia Tefi was earlier and Skada was later, but everything tells us that Zedekiah had two daughters. Okay, so according to the Chronicles of Eri or Eri, and the Chronicles of Scotland and the Annals of the Four Masters, Capt has pieced together this scenario. Jeremiah took with him two of Zedekiah's daughters, whose names were Skada and Tia Tefi. The various chroniclers traced these two women to Egypt, and from Egypt through Spain and on to Ireland. Skada is said to have married Gallo, Gethelius, progenitor of the Gauls, and a Milesian chieftain descended from Zerah. Okay, that would be Miles. Okay? This marriage took place during the reign of the Egyptian pharaoh Hophra, the pharaoh who provided refuge for Jeremiah and his entourage. Hophra died in 566 B.C. Gathalus was apparently the father of Jochide, who married Tia Tefi. So there's all kinds of connections here between these two daughters of Zedekiah and the Western migration. Okay.
Well, the only thing I'll say in support of that is that the a Milesian chieftain descended from Zara is probably because the Carians took their princes from the Trojans.
Mm-hmm.
So the royal line of the Milesians, that their leaders were certainly probably Zarahites.
Yes, yes. Now, in Jeremiah chapter 24, and we're talking about the good figs, bad figs scenario in the scriptures, the Lord showed me, and behold, two baskets of figs were set before the temple of the Lord after that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away captive Jeconiah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. One basket had very good figs, even like the figs that are first ripe, and the other basket had very naughty figs, which could not be eaten. They were so bad. Thus saith Yahweh, like these good figs, so I will acknowledge them that are carried away captive of Judah, whom I have sent out of this place into the land of the Chaldeans for their good. Okay, so the good figs are the ones who went to Babylon with Nebuchadnezzar, okay, and allowed themselves to be taken captive, as Jeremiah prophesied that everything will turn out well if you allow this to happen. And I have to reboot here, get back into the website here. But he continues, for I will set mine eyes upon them for good, and I will bring them up again to this land, and I will build them and not pull them down, and I will plant them and not pluck them. So he's basically prophesying the return of these Babylonian captives back to Judah and reestablishing the kingdom there. Okay? And this would be, you know, the return of the captives from Babylon. Now, continuing with the evil figs, and as the evil figs, which cannot be eaten, they are so evil, surely as thus saith the Lord, so will I give Zedekiah, the king of Judah, and his princes, and the residue of Jerusalem that remain in this land, and them that dwell in the land of Egypt, again, connecting these this remnant of Judah to Egypt, and I will deliver them to be removed into all the kingdoms of the earth for their hurt, to be a reproach and a proverb, a taunt and a curse in all the places whither I shall drive them. Now, my interpretation here of the bad figs is that, well, when when the Israelites first asked to have a king, Yahweh told them, well, your kings aren't going to treat you very well, okay? And that was true of the kings who remained in the land of Judah, as well as these kings who migrated west under Zerah, okay? So that these bad figs are actually talking about kings and queens who are nevertheless Judahites, okay, but who weren't treating the people very well, okay?
Well,
so that
I don't see the parable of the bad figs that way. I see that as I mean, those figs are so bad they can't even be eaten, that they are the race mixers. And
okay, and
Yahweh would sift us through the places where he scattered us,
mm-hmm,
in order to separate them from the true wheat.
Right, okay. Well, given either interpretation here, there's no doubt that the Judahites under Zerah went west. They went west, and all the legends tell us that they wound up as far as Ireland, okay? So that what we're talking about here is whether these let's talk about the British throne theory here for a minute, because it says the British throne theory teaches that the daughters of King Zedekiah went with Jeremiah to Egypt, then to Spain, and then to Ireland, where it married back into another branch of the tribe of Judah. This may be all true, but was Zedekiah the rightful heir to the throne of David, and did Yahweh bless this? Okay, so this is according to L.E. Jandaber in the Western Migration Theory. Okay, so whether your version is correct or mine, you know, we can still we have to do more research here, but it's fairly evident that the Israelites under the tribe of Judah migrated west and established the kingdoms of the British Isles.
Well, right, but I mean the Zarahites, most of Judah left Judea by the people that the Judah that ruled over the children of Israel in the Western Islands. They left 800 years before Jeremiah.
Mm-hmm.
They may have left from Egypt, or they may have left before Egypt.
Right, right. Well, yeah, that brings up the three waves of migration that I promised I would talk about, and the first one was from Egypt around 1500 BC, and that's because Zerah Judah in this scarlet thread theory, okay, left the company of the Israelites there because there was a dispute between Zerah and Pharez as to which would be the leading line of the kingly tribes, right? So the Zerahites decided to leave, and they founded Troy and what was the other area under Chalcol?
Pamphylia.
Pamphylia, okay. And then from Pamphylia and points around Troy, they migrated toward Rome, and then finally toward Spain.
They actually split into two groups after the Trojan Wars.
Okay.
The first group migrated to Rome. The second group crossed the Bosphorus into the land north of Macedonia and became known as the Illyrians.
Illyrians? Okay.
Yes, the Illyrians. The Illyrians are actually descendants of the Trojans.
Okay.
And they, as Procopius said, they had a tribe called the Dardans among them to his day.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And Justinian, the emperor, was a Dardan by race.
Okay.
He was a descendant of Judah's era.
Fascinating. So this first wave came from Egypt, and they were Israelites who decided they didn't want to be captives to the Egyptians anymore and left. Okay. Now, of course, the Bible doesn't say much about this, so we have to, as we're discussing now, we have to go into secular history to establish this first wave of the migration, okay? And we've been discussing primarily now the second wave of migration, which is around, well, before the Assyrian captivity, and also including the period up to and the Babylonian captivity, because during this time, after the Israelites had settled in Palestine, they realized that the Assyrians were coming to invade, and many of these Israelites decided to leave rather than become captive to the Assyrians, okay? And so this I call the Cimmerian wave, okay? Because most of these people were called Cimmerians after King Omri of the northern house of Israel. Okay?
Well, I don't know if they would have called themselves Cimmerians.
No, they didn't call themselves that.
I don't think so. And the people that came into Ireland and Britain, they were called Cymry.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they would have called themselves Cymry because they were only known by that name in the dispersion on Assyrian language tablets,
right.
Akkadian
right.
tablets.
Yes. Yeah, well, all I'm saying is that the surrounding people, especially the Assyrians, called them Cumru, okay, but after King Omri of Israel. And that's how the Cimmerians got their name. And Cimmerian is a Greek term that the Greeks applied to these same people.
Right, but I see the Cymry of Britain arriving there through the Caucasus Mountains, through the crossing to Europe from the shores of Germany.
Okay.
That's the way I see it.
Okay.
They arrive in Britain about 400 BC.
Okay.
And
okay.
by then, the Scythians, who descended from the Cimmerians, are already raiding Rome,
mm-hmm.
and they're already inhabiting the
okay.
Baltic shores of Germany.
Okay. So, well, let's talk then about the Phoenicians, because you seem to think that the Cimmerians arrived in Britain a little later. Obviously, the Israelite migration of the Phoenicians was earlier, okay, and also by sea.
Well, I believe the Phoenicians were probably the first Israelite Adamic. I mean, there may have been other people there, and archaeology seems there are barrows dated in Ireland. They're dated back as far as 3000 BC.
Yes.
And there's no doubt to me that there were Japhethites there before the Phoenicians ever were.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And that would account for those barrows. I don't know how habitable Ireland was at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It probably still had a very cold climate.
Right, right.
Okay? And the archaeological findings have been sparse, but they are there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no disputing that there were people in Ireland. I don't know if I would date those barrows all the way back to 3000 BC. I know that carbon dating is very shaky after a couple of thousand years, and that the modern archaeologists and anthropologists always tend to push their finds back as far as possible.
Sure, sure. Because the secular archaeologists want to validate the theory of evolution.
well, right. That's basically what it boils down to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now the Phoenicians were mining tin in Cornwall.
Mm-hmm.
1,000 years before Tacitus' time, and Tacitus that's just a round number, right?
Yeah.
And there's no doubt that they weren't mining tin in Cornwall by the time of Solomon, which
mm-hmm.
would be 1,000 years before Tacitus' time, which would be 1,000 BC.
Right.
Now, Strabo discusses the tin mining in Cornwall, and so does Diodorus Siculus. And he calls Cornwall Bellerium. And the only etymology I could give to Bellerium.
Mm-hmm. Right.
and air in Hebrew is a city, is a word for city.
Yes.
Bel Air actually means city of Bel.
Right, right.
And Bellerium would be a Romanized version of that, city
right,
of Bel.
Right.
And
yeah,
that is the outpost from which the tin departs, according to Strabo, from Cornwall, from what we know today as Cornwall,
yeah.
to Gaul.
Right, right.
And the Phoenician tin trade is conducted
yes.
in that manner.
Now, we understand these Phoenicians were primarily – you know, let's say, 90 to 95% Israelites, because we know the Israelites did the sailing, they did the work, they did the mining, okay? And there were probably some Canaanite businessmen making money off the deal, okay?
Well, I wouldn't doubt if there weren't Canaanites among the Phoenicians. They used
yes.
them for slaves early on, and they
mm-hmm.
they had Canaanite merchants. There's no doubt. Scripture.
Right. So these were paganized, the Phoenicians are paganized Israelites. That's what we're saying here, okay?
Well, they did exactly what the Old Testament said they would do.
Mm-hmm.
They followed the ways of Canaan and adopted the Canaanite gods, the bell and the
right.
child sacrifice and all the horrible things that can be said about them.
Right.
Now, let me Nennius lists all the cities in Britain.
Okay.
At the earliest cities in Britain. And in Nennius's writing, there's 30-something of the earliest cities in Britain, and they all begin with the word care, C-A-I-R.
Okay.
Now, that word care, that is a Hebrew word that means city.
City, okay.
Yes. Kir, it's spelled Kir in the concordance.
Uh-huh.
Q-I-Y-R.
Oh, okay.
Is the way Strong spells it, okay?
Interesting.
However, you know, Carthage, C-A-R.
Okay.
T-H-A-G-E.
Right.
That's how the Romans spelled Carhadash.
Uh-huh.
Or Kir Hadash. Okay? Kir Hadash means new city.
Right.
In Hebrew.
Yes.
Carthage.
Exactly.
Is the way the Romans,
yes,
Romanized it.
Yeah. And, of course, the original name of the city of London was Caer Troy.
Well, that's I haven't seen that in writing. I've heard that was in Caesar, and I know it not to be.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I'm still looking. I know that there were British Israel World Federation writers,
uh-huh,
that made that statement.
Right.
I have not.
Many of them. And they claim that Brutus was the one who named it Caer Troy.
Well, right, but I haven't. Yeah, you know, I've read all of Caesar's writing.
Uh-huh.
It's not in there.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Now I've yet to read Pliny. But I've read British Israel writers that said it was Caesar that said that.
Right.
And Caesar,
yes,
didn't say it. I'm sorry.
Okay. Okay. Well, I haven't read that Caesar said that, but I know the story goes back to Brutus, who is claimed by British Israel writers to be the founder of the city of London. Okay.
Well, there is, you know, the Trinovantes is the British tribe. That's what Caesar called them.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems that it could be interpreted as New Troy.
Yes.
But it's the name of the tribe. And
mm-hmm.
and it really, New Trojans might be pushing the meaning of it.
Right, right.
And we don't, you know, we only know how the Latins,
right,
how the Latin speakers romanized the pronunciation and their spelling.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's words always get butchered when they're portrayed in,
sure,
one language, you know, from another. That's
right,
the way it is.
Right, yeah. Well, we have various linguistic connections between ancient Israel and Britain, okay, and the gods they worshipped while they were in their pagan era, okay. They brought the names of these gods with them from Phoenicia to the various British Isles and Gaul and various other places. And that's why they're common in these areas. It's because it's the Israelites that brought the names of these gods and goddesses. In fact, Cilicia is the name of the goddess of Galicia in northern Spain, where Miletus or Miletus and Scata lived. Okay, and that would be the origin of the name Gael. It's based on this word Cilicia. Okay, according to the Irish legends themselves. Okay, let me quote here. From the same website, cai.org/Bible studies, a clear connection can be established through archaeological finds like the Black Obelisk, which can be seen at the British Museum. And I think you just referred to that had the three languages where the Israelites referred to as Cimmerians, Saka, and what was the third one? Do you recall?
Well, it's the Black Obelisk. I know two of the languages, an Akkadian. They're called Cymry, which is the Greek Cimmeroi or
Cimmeroi. Right. Right.
All right. And in Persian, in the Persian equivalent on the Black Obelisk, they're called Saka.
Saka.
And the Greeks called, you know, the Greeks called the first of the Scythians. Let me call them Scythians.
Right.
General term. When they first migrated from Asia into Europe, the Greeks called them Cimmeroi.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Greeks started to call them Cimmeroi, that's because the Assyrian Empire was still intact, and Akkadian, the Assyrian language,
yes,
was the lingua franca.
Mm-hmm.
And Cimmeroi is clearly a Hellenization of the Assyrian Cymry.
Right.
That there's no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, later waves were called by the Greeks Sakans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the later waves came when the Persians were had the hegemony in Asia.
Right.
And Aramaic was the lingua franca.
Right, right. And these Sakans, they primarily migrated overland through the Caucasus Mountains and south of the Black Sea into Greece, etc.
Well, right, but whether they're Kimmeroi or whether they're Sakans, they're all the same people.
Right.
It's just that the Greeks labeled one wave of them after the Assyrian name because they learned who they were from the Assyrians.
Right.
And they learned who the later waves are from the Persians. Yeah, you know, who are these people pouring into Europe?
Right.
And they start calling them after the Persian names.
Right.
But the Greeks called them all Scythians.
Right. Okay.
And later called them Galatahi.
Right.
Or Galatians.
Uh-huh. Okay. So there are different names for the same people in
different
eras.
Times,
right. Okay. Very good. So the same author backs up exactly what you just said. It says a clear connection can be established through archaeological finds between the Israelites who were deported by the Assyrians and a people called Beth Kumri or Gomri, Assyrian name, Kimmeroi, Greek, Saka, Persian, or Scythians. Okay? All these names are given by different nations to the same people, the Israelites. One resource that explains this more fully is the Tribes by Yair Davidi. Now, of course, we know that Yair Davidi is a Judaizer who tries to claim that
Go to see Yair Davidi.
Yeah,
go to Christogenia and look at the classical records in German origin.
Okay, yeah, right, because the Germans are Judah. Okay. Now, he also says the Milesians also called themselves Scots, and part of them settled later on in Scotland. The Scottish Declaration of Independence, the Declaration of Arbroath, 1320 A.D., makes the following statement, quote, "We know, most holy father and lord, from the chronicles and books of the ancients, gather that among the other illustrious nations, ours, to wit, the nation of the Scots, has been distinguished by many honors, which passing from the greater Scythia, through the Mediterranean Sea and Pillars of Hercules, which is the history we've just been discussing, and sojourning in Spain among the most savage tribes through a long course of time, could nowhere be subjugated by any people, however barbarous, and coming thence 1,200 years after the outgoing of the people of Israel, from Egypt, of course, they, by many victories and infinite toil, acquired for themselves the possessions in the West, which they now hold," which in general describes the quotation from Isaiah 11:11 through 14 that we started the show with. Okay? So there's clear evidence from the Declaration of Arbroath that they originated in Scythia, migrated through along the Mediterranean Sea, sojourned in Spain, and then on there to Ireland and eventually Scotland.
And the only way that makes sense is if they were Malaysians, not of Miletus. And the Malaysians of Miletus are said to have colonies in Spain.
Okay.
But they had to be Malaysians from one of the Black Sea colonies.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right.
Which, you know, would have been considered Scythia.
Right.
At a very early time.
Yes, right. Okay. So let's tie this together with the Egyptian history here, and the fact that now it says here, the city of Miletus or Miletus in Asia Minor was founded by colonists from Athens at or about 1000 BC. Does that jive with your Greek study?
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
That's the evolutionist viewpoint.
Okay.
All the Greek classics say that Caria and the city, well, the Athenians did found some cities. But Miletus is a Phoenician city.
Okay.
Its most prominent citizen, Thales, is called a Phoenician by race by Herodotus.
Uh-huh.
And he's the one of the first great so-called Greek philosophers.
Right. Well, he quotes Herodotus here, saying that they were, these people of Miletus, were from the government house in Athens and of the purest Ionian blood.
Well, it could be that the Athenians came to rule over the Malays.
Okay.
But
okay.
I don't know. I would have to look into that before I commented on it.
Yeah, okay.
I don't. As far as I'm concerned, the Malaysians, their stock is Phoenician.
Right.
The Carians are Phoenician and not Ionians.
Okay.
But, you know, both the Ionian Greeks and the Dorian Greeks made many settlements in Anatolia at various times.
Okay. Okay.
Herodotus is a Dorian Greek, but he's from Halicarnassus, which is actually, it's I think it's in Caria. I'm not sure, but it's in eastern Anatolia. It's not in. He's not a Dorian Greek from Sparta or Corinth.
Okay. And the Ionians are from Japheth, Jovan. Is that true?
Yes. The Ionians are absolutely from Japheth.
Okay.
They're Jovan, Genesis chapter 10, verse 2. Jovan is first mentioned.
Okay.
The Persians, in their inscriptions, call the Ionians Yavanna.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So they're definitely kinsmen of the Israelites.
Well, they're Japhethites.
Yes.
And that's why Paul goes to Athens, Acts chapter 17, and he does not talk to them about redemption and reconciliation with Yahweh and the law and you know, the anything to do with the Old Testament history.
Yeah.
He talks to them from a very
general
Genesis 3:23 viewpoint.
Okay.
They're also children of Adam. So they're also children of God. As he says, even some of your own poets have said that you are children of God. And that's what Paul tells the Athenians. And that Yahweh had allowed all the nations to go their own way, but to see if they would seek after him.
Yes.
You know, and that's Paul's message to the non-Israelite Adamic people.
Right, the Japhethites in that area. Right, very good.
Right, and that why I raise that point is that supports the contention that the Athenians are Japhethites.
Right, exactly, very good. And he continues here, we learn that Athens was founded by a band of colonists from the city of Sais in Egypt, led by Cecrops, otherwise known as Chalcol, a member of the Zerah branch of the Judahites. His brother Dardanos, Darda, founded the famous city of Troy.
Now this I have no, you know, the founding of Athens by anybody but the Ionians and you know, that they're called Argives at times because Argos is that region of Greece around Athens.
Jason and the Argonauts, right?
Well, right, and I don't see any
okay
Israelite connection with the founding of Athens.
Okay.
I've never seen it in literature.
So, but it's,
I have seen it, you know, Charles Totten. He was a British Israel, more or less, academic in the late 1800s.
Yes. Okay.
And he made that claim, but I haven't seen it documented.
Okay, but from your perspective, Athens was founded by Japhethites, and then it could be the case that these Chalcolites of Zerah Judah moved in later, okay, and joined up with them? What's your...
Well, it's pretty clear in the ancient history that Chalcol is the legendary founder of Pamphylia.
Okay.
Which is in Anatolia and has nothing to do with Athens or Ionia.
Okay.
Ionia would, when I say Ionia, I don't mean any, you know, Athens. I mean the district called Ionia was a collection of Greek, of Athenian Greek settlements on the western coast of Anatolia.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Which so, and that, well, that, isn't that Pamphylia too?
No. Pamphylia is on the southern coast of Anatolia.
Okay. All right. So we have Japhethites on the far western, and we have Israelites on the southern edge of western Anatolia.
Right. I've never read anything in Greek literature connecting Chalcol to Athens.
Okay. But clearly we place Chalcol. We start him off in Egypt, and he settles, in, according to your history, in Pamphylia. And then from there, and his brother Darda founded the famous city of Troy. So
yes,
we definitely have established a connection to Israel from the first wave to those two colonies. Okay, and now we're tracing the second wave, which might be more correctly called the Phoenician wave, into across the Mediterranean, into northern Spain and probably other settlements of Spain. What's your understanding of the Phoenicians settling Spain? How much of Spain did they settle?
Well, the first settlers of Spain were Tarkesians or Tarshish.
Right.
They were Japhethites. And Tartessus was southeastern Spain. And even Herodotus says that Tarsus was a small outpost but became a great trading city sometime after the Trojan War, which would mean it became a great trading city during the time of Hiram and Solomon, which is about 150, 180 years after the Trojan War.
Right. Okay. And after, of course, the kingdom was established in Israel by the Israelites. So these Phoenicians, many of the sailors were probably Israelites of Solomon and David's time.
Right. But I'm certain that the Phoenicians probably settled most of the river valleys in Spain and France. I can't prove it, but I believe it to be so.
Okay.
And it's something that I have to develop more fully.
Yeah. Okay, one more sentence from this section here. Chalcol is said to have founded 14 cities in and around Greece. The city of Chalcis, located north of Athens, seems to bear his name. The Argonauts traveled to a region called Colchis on the Black Sea coast in order to retrieve the Golden Fleece.
Well, that would be Colchia, yes.
Yes. The Colchians had strong connections to Greece, Israel, and Egypt. In conclusion, there is ample proof that the Milesians were indeed Israelites. Okay.
For some strange reason, Herodotus said that the Colchians were black, and I could never figure that passage out,
okay.
And I don't believe that he had a very good informer in that aspect.
Well, doesn't the Hebrew word that's often translated as black also mean tanned? So maybe he was just talking about their tan skin, having come from Egypt.
Well, I'm simply not sure.
Okay.
But the Colchians, I think that, yeah, you know, it's really a stretch to put I don't know when the Argonautica is, yeah, you know, the Jason and the Argonaut story existed at an early time.
Uh-huh.
But probably it's hard to say demonstrably that it existed before 600 BC when Homer was known to have written.
Yes, yes. Okay.
You know, we don't know, but the Argonautica itself wasn't written until by Apollonius Rhodius until about 200 BC, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, you know, the Argonautica being the most famous account of the story.
Yes, right.
So these things, yeah, you know, they were written down just like the Irish myths. They were written down long after that the events were supposed to have taken place.
Right, right. Now he quotes from a secular source, L. Evans, from her book printed in the Yorkshire Post, 25 August 2000. Quote, Egyptian theory on ancient Humber boats states ancient Egyptians swapped the Nile for the Humber, which apparently is in England, the Humber.
Well, the Humber is a river in England, yes.
Okay.
Northumbria is the province above or north of the Humber.
Okay. Ancient Egyptians swapped the Nile for the Humber in one of the earliest trade missions to our shores, according to a new book. Egyptologist Lorraine Evans claims in The Kingdom of the Ark that evidence from the discovery of three boats on the shores of the Humber shows Egyptians, quote, unquote, of course, Egyptians, were shipwrecked near Hull about 3,500 years ago. She speculates they had forsaken the ancient wonders of Egypt for a trade journey to Britain, but had come to grief in a storm within swimming distance of the shore, sparking the intriguing possibility they may have made their way to land and could have settled in the area, leaving some inhabitants of the East riding with ancient Egyptian roots. Okay. But
well,
of course,
Egypt wasn't a it wasn't this little desert kingdom, right?
Right.
I mean, the Egyptians had many ports of call throughout the Mediterranean.
Yes, and of course.
And they had a great mercantile fleet. A lot of people don't realize this.
So the Egyptian fleet, which was probably also manned by Israelites, right? Because the Israelites were the greatest sailors. And
well,
we had
1500 B.C., I would suspect that might actually be Hebrews.
Yes, right. And the Egyptians were actually Hamites mixed with Hebrews, okay?
Well, let's put it this way. You know, by all Greek accounts, the Danae fled Egypt before the Exodus and settled the Peloponnesus.
Mm-hmm.
Now they must have known how to sail and where they were going in order to do that. And by all Greek accounts, they were well accepted by the inhabitants
mm-hmm.
of the Peloponnesus.
Yes, yes.
Who were called Argives at the time.
Uh-huh, okay. All right, continuing here. Her theory, also drawing on finds from other parts of the country, suggests ancient Egyptian culture could have had a significant impact on early British life, claiming a princess who was Tutankhamun's half-sister set up a colony in Ireland. Quote, three wooden boats were discovered by archaeologists in mud on the banks of the Humber in North Ferriby in 1937 and were at first mistaken for Viking longships. It was not until they were radiocarbon dated that it was firmly established they were Bronze Age craft dating from 7 to 400 BC. Now we're back in the era of Miletus. In the article, she is quoted to say, every traditional text recounting the history of the British Isles would have to be rewritten. Indeed, it'd have to be rewritten as the history of the Israelites. The simple fact that many peoples of Britain are going about their daily business unaware of their Egyptian heritage is astounding in itself. Okay? So, now, here we have secular evidence of what we're talking about. Okay? But these archaeologists don't understand the British Israel theory, and of course we in Christian Identity pretty much agree with what they teach in that the British Isles, Spain, Normandy, Denmark, et cetera, were settled by Israelites from these early migrations. Okay, and so it's just a matter of time before the secular archaeologists begin to understand this and start admitting the Israel connection to the British Isles. Okay, but they don't want to go into religious territory, do they? They don't want to verify the Bible. But these archaeologists are getting closer and closer to what's really going on in terms of the migrations, okay?
Well, there's the Amesbury Archer was found a few years ago.
Amesbury Archer.
The Amesbury, A-M-E-S-B-U-R-Y. That's the name of a man they found with accoutrements that they say came from the, that they say that his... The elements in his teeth and things like that prove he came from the Alps. But
okay.
The accoutrements are all Phoenician.
Okay. Yes.
And I would claim that they were Phoenician.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. Yeah. And there's no doubt that the Phoenicians could have, gone north into Italy and toward the Alps. Okay. So there's no – in fact, they got around – the Phoenician, and I think this is why – it's erroneously stated that the Phoenicians originated the Hebrew script, because it's really obvious that the Phoenicians coming later in history than the Hebrews, and Hebrew and Phoenician are virtually identical according to all commentators. I don't think I've ever found anybody who says otherwise, okay? It's not possible that Phoenician is the original language. It had to be Hebrew. Okay.
Well, Phoenician is Hebrew, as far as I'm concerned.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Phoenician is Hebrew.
Yeah, the Hebrews came first. They couldn't have learned Hebrew from the Phoenicians.
Well, the Hebrews came first, and the Greeks called them Phoenicians.
Right. Okay.
Well,
right.
Well, the Greeks don't have they don't have Israelites in their lexicon.
Yeah. Yeah. Because
they don't have Hebrews in their lexicon.
Yeah.
They have Iberia in their lexicon.
Uh-huh.
And they have the Iberia in the Caucasus and the Iberia in the Iberian Peninsula.
Right.
But the Greeks don't have Israelites in their lexicon.
Yeah, and they refer to the various waves of Israelites as Cimmerioi.
Well, yeah, Saka. Right. The Cimmeri, the sack of the Scythians. But concerning Palestine, I mean, Homer wrote about 600
mm-hmm.
About 600 BC, I know a lot of I know a lot of people want to date Homer a lot earlier than that, but the testimony of a contemporary who definitely, without a doubt, wrote about 585 BC named Archilochus,
uh-huh.
and he was an elegiac poet, and he knew Homer. He Homer wrote during his lifetime.
So in other words, what you're saying is that the Greeks arrived on the scene too late to know anything really
well,
about
not the Greeks themselves, but their writing.
Right.
There's a dark age over Greece that's 400 or 500 years.
Okay.
That when they start writing, they're writing about stuff that happened 500 years before their time.
Yeah, yeah.
600 years before their time.
So,
there was a long dark age in Greece where no writing took place. And we know very little about that period.
Okay.
We know about the Trojan Wars between. We know about the arrival of the Danaans from Egypt into Greece,
mm-hmm.
into the Peloponnesus, right?
Yes.
And we know that the Ionians and the Argives and the Pelasgi are the names of tribes that are already there.
Right.
And we know about the Trojan Wars. And we know about the Dorian conquest. The Dorians came 2-3 generations after the fall of Troy.
They were Israelites from Dora.
And yes, they were.
Mm-hmm.
And they conquered the Peloponnesus from the Danaans.
Okay.
Okay? But aside from that, we have a huge blackout.
Okay.
We know nothing between, or let's say we know extremely little about the period between the Dorian invasions. Well, which is why I doubt this account of Miletus and the Ionians in 1000 B.C., right?
Okay.
We know extremely little about history in Greece from the time of the Dorian invasions all the way down to the time of Herodotus and the other writers, the poets who start writing around the time of Homer, and that's sometime shortly after or right around 600 B.C.
Okay. So
now,
from
Homer,
around,
in his lifetime, he witnessed, or he knew about it at least. He may not have seen it personally, but that the Greeks were aware of it. Homer knew about the Cimmerian invasions of Anatolia and movements into Europe.
Yes. Okay, so
He was fully aware. He was fully aware of the destruction of Phrygia at the hand of the Cimmerians.
Right. So from around 1000 B.C., which would be the time of the Phoenicians, okay, to 600 B.C., the Greeks really had little intercourse, or it's not demonstrable that they had intercourse with the Israelites and the people in that area.
Well, Homer writing about 600 B.C. talks about Tyre.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm sorry. He doesn't mention Tyre. He talks about Sidon.
Okay.
He does not mention Tyre, and that might be appropriate for the time frame he's writing about.
Yes.
Because he's writing about the Trojan Wars and 1200 B.C.
Right.
To 1180 B.C.
Well, Sidon was earlier.
Now, Sidon was always there, right?
Yes.
And Tyre, it was there was a mainland city there that the Akkadians called Ushu in their language.
Okay.
That's what mainland Tyre was called by the Akkadians.
Oh, okay.
But according to Josephus, the island city was built 240 years before the temple.
Okay, before the temple. Okay.
Well, which puts it around 1220 B.C.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Okay, so Homer's not mentioning it because that's the time period he's talking about.
Yeah.
And I would think that Homer probably thought it wasn't there.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, you know, because Homer, Strabo calls Homer's writing ex artes, meaning from the beginning.
Okay. Okay.
He's the first geographer, he considered him.
Right.
And even though he's writing poetry and a lot of it's fanciful, that all of his talk about nations and peoples and tribes, yeah, you know, all those nations and peoples and tribes for the most part exist.
Okay. But 1200 B.C. was when the Israelites were in there.
Well, that's
conquering
the beginning.
The land.
Basically, that's the beginning. Well, no, I put the, all the mainstream so-called scholars, they try to put the Exodus in the time of Ramses.
Okay.
And that would be the 13th century B.C.
Okay.
And that's just straight B.S.
Okay.
With a capital B and a capital S.
Okay. Well, what's the correct time frame?
Let's just take Josephus's word for it.
Okay.
And Josephus says that the Exodus happened during the reign of Thutmose.
Okay.
Now Clifton did a hell of a lot of research that supports that.
Okay.
That shows that the Exodus definitely happened in the reign of Thutmose.
Okay.
Probably Thutmose III. And this is – we're talking about 1450, 1480 in there, B.C.
Mm-hmm.
By 1400 BC, the Israelites are pouring into the land of Canaan.
Okay. Yes, so 1400 BC. Okay.
Now, the Trojan War is about 1185 BC.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, okay.
And David, the time of David, I mean, there's varying chronologies here, but the time of David can safely be estimated about 1020 BC, the beginning of his
mm-hmm.
reign.
Maybe
a little sooner, and Solomon about 1000 to 980 BC.
Okay. So to the Greeks, these actual Israelites were simply known to them as Phoenicians, as Chimerioi, as Saka, and other names that they, from what you're saying, they never realized they were Israelites.
Well, right. The
mm-hmm.
Greeks don't start writing until 600 BC.
Okay.
I mean, Israel's gone already.
Right. And your secular historians basically follow the Greeks, who are unaware that these people are, in fact, Israelites.
The temple sacked by the Chaldeans in 586 BC.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Well, then I would say the history of our people in the Mediterranean basin and their migration west is undeniable. It's undeniable. We know that the Irish and the Scots and Gaels all descended from Israelites. They have it in their own histories. Their own histories proven. Of course, some of the legends are sketchy, but whatever legends there are tend to confirm their origin in Israel. Okay, the mainstream archaeologists and historians simply do not want to recognize the origin of our people in Israel. But the fact is, for example, that Welsh is virtually 100% Hebrew, okay, and that the Gaelic languages are very much related to Hebrew, and that can't be coincidental.
I believe that that's, and the difference between P-Celtic and Q-Celtic, I can't get too much into the details there because I can't prove what I'm about to say.
Mm-hmm.
I can only conjecture some things, but there are a lot of things I can prove.
Okay.
The Chimeroi crossed Europe very quickly.
Okay.
Okay? Within 200 years. Okay?
Okay?
They had departed from where they were placed by the Assyrians. They were the first Scythians to cross into Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And they had reached the shores of the Baltic by 450 BC.
Okay.
That one group of them had crossed into Britain by 400 BC. Another group of them had raided Rome by 390
mm-hmm.
and, BC. Now, I believe that's where the Cymri came from.
Okay.
Okay? Now, the Picts, by all accounts, did come from Scythia.
Okay.
Okay? Or from Germany.
Okay.
All right? Which is what Scythia really is.
Right. The larger, greater Scythia. Right.
Well, you know, Tacitus said that Germany... His description of Germany goes all the way to the Black Sea.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay. He
right.
don't stop.
Right.
Now, and
so that would be what I would call third wave, the Anglo-Saxon wave.
Well, there were the third and fourth. There's probably more than that.
Right.
I don't think the Saxons, the people that we know as the Anglo-Saxons, they were probably one of the latest waves.
Right. They were the last wave, yeah.
To Germany. However, the Angli are mentioned by Tacitus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. Now there are waves of Scythian Israelites into Europe all the way up to the Goths and the Huns are a lot of the Huns were surely Scythian Israelites.
Uh-huh. Right.
That they weren't all aliens. Some of them were mixed, but they were for the most part tall and white and fair, as described by Procopius.
Yes.
And excellent horsemen, and they meet all the qualifications, you know, all the descriptions of the other.
Right.
Scythians.
Well, even
their,
to this
predecessor.
Yeah, even to this day, the majority of the people of Hungary are white people. You know, obviously, as you say, they did mix because the Mongol hordes.
Well, right, but no, there was a huge influx of Magyars.
Right.
Most of the people in Hungary today are Magyars, and they came much later.
Mm-hmm.
They came in the Slavic invasions that ran from maybe about 500-600 AD all the way to the 10th
right.
century.
Yeah, but my point being that the Hungarians today are still primarily white, and their leadership is white, okay? You see, you know, a few white people with slant eyes. Okay, so you can see some of the Mongol mixing that was going on in there. But their origin is white, and as you said, it's Slavic, primarily Slavic.
Now Tacitus describes the Picts And he calls them Caledonians.
Okay.
And he says that their red hair and large limbs, that proclaims a German origin.
Right, right. Okay.
All right?
Yes.
But now, none of these writers know
Viking.
The Scots. Mm-hmm. No Greek writer knows of these people called the Scots.
Okay.
And the early Roman writers don't know of the Scots.
Okay.
Okay, and that's why that's why I have a hard time with that name Scotty, and if it was really prevalent, I think that someone should have known it.
Well,
Theodorus Siculus, he calls the Irish the Britons of Ireland.
Okay, okay,
it's basically what
yeah.
He considers them to be the same people as the Britons.
Right.
Well, and the language is probably very similar.
Yeah.
But the Cymry spoke a different Celtic.
Uh-huh.
Dialect, because the other inhabitants of Ireland, I believe, were Phoenicians,
yes,
and Danans that came by sea,
right,
at an earlier time.
Okay, okay, but the time frame fits because the sources I've been reading say that all of this happened around 700 BC, which would have been that Dark Age that the Greeks experienced. Okay, so that's probably why they didn't. And in fact, Scotland wasn't named until the Gaels of Ireland crossed over from Ireland into Scotland. So Scotland was named much later, so probably the Irish who remember Scota, who broke away from Ireland, named the Scottish Peninsula Scotland in honor of Scotland.
Well, from the accounts I have, Scotland was probably settled by – I mean, it wasn't – the Picts and the Scots weren't unified until Kenneth I MacAlpin in like the 11th century.
Okay.
AD.
Okay, yeah.
That's when the Picts and the Scots were unified.
Mm-hmm.
They were consistently warring with each other,
right,
over Scotland until then.
Right.
I mean, that's a long time.
Right.
Now the Scots probably crossed from Ireland in the very early 3rd century AD.
Okay. Okay. So they could have, differentiating themselves from the Irish, they chose to name it Scotia as commander, or Scotia as sometimes it's pronounced, Scotland. Okay, the evidence indicates that it is indeed named after the woman named Scotta. Okay.
Now Bede calls all of the Irish Scots.
Okay. Yeah.
Consistently.
Okay.
He calls them all Scots.
Yeah. Right.
He calls Ireland Scotland.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Now, from and he was writing in what time period was that?
He was writing in the seventh or eighth century.
Okay,
AD.
Right.
Bede, the venerable Bede,
the
famous the ecclesiastical history.
Yes,
he was a church writer.
So the differentiation between the Irish and the Scots is a much later historical development, and so even Bede refers to the Irish as Scots.
He called them all Scots,
okay,
whether they were in Scotland,
yes,
or Ireland. They're all Scots.
Very interesting. Okay. So now, according to the legends and according to the biblical stories of the migrations that we've been quoting, and various chroniclers from Greece, Germany, Ireland, you name it, this story rings true. And the fact that the British people speak, and especially the Welsh and the Gaels, speak a dialect of Hebrew, and it's undeniable that it's a dialect of Hebrew, all are indications that these people originated in Israel, okay, whether via the Phoenicians, whether via the Cimmerians, okay, and whether via the Zarahemlaites, okay, they all originated in Israel, okay? And that's the story, and I'm sticking to it, okay? So, well, thank you, Bill. This has been very instructive. Obviously, the secular world needs to investigate the British Israel claims of this history in Israel, and we agree with much of it, okay? Obviously, some of it still needs to be ironed out, with closer study, but everything indicates that our ancestors in the British Isles are, in fact, Israelites, and, of course, northern Spain, Israelites, Iberia. In fact, Spain used to be called Iberia, meaning land of the Hebrews, okay? All of this history jives with the stories of the ancient Israelites and the various names they were known under, okay, named by other people, okay? So,
well, to me, the proof that Iberia should be Hebrew land, I mean, it's clear from the, once you understand it, the Phoenicians are
Hebrews.
Are Hebrew Israelites.
Right.
But we have this Iberia for many centuries in the Western, you know,
Anatolia.
Part of Europe. And then after the deportations of the children of Israel, when they crossed the Caucasus Mountains, the first land they name is Iberia.
Right, right.
And why would they, you know, and that shows me that,
they're Hebrews.
Hebrews are want to do that.
They're Hebrews, absolutely, absolutely. Okay, very good. All right, so let me just conclude tonight by making a couple of announcements that tomorrow my guest will be Greg Howard. We're going to be talking part three, angels, demons, and prophecy. We're going to be talking primarily about demons in Scripture, the reality of demons in the spiritual world. Next Friday, Bill and I will continue our series on Isaiah. Saturday afternoon, I'll be on with Sword Brethren on the Come Out of Her show. We'll be talking of Matthew chapter 24, which contains the prophecies of the end times, very serious prophecies of the end times. And then next Saturday night, Bill and I are going to begin our series on the Ephesians, correct?
Yes, can't
yes.
wait.
Okay, so that's the upcoming schedule for from tonight onward. Thank you for listening this evening. This is the history of the migrations of the 12 tribes of Israel is a story that's not going to go away, folks. We're going to prove to the world that we are Israelites of the Bible and the Jews are imposters, okay? The Jews are definitely imposters, not a branch of the tribe of Judah, nor are they any part of Israel at all, okay? That is very clear to us in Christian identity. The British Israelites are trying to hold the door open to let the Jews in as part of Judah. That is a lie, folks. It's absolutely false, okay? So we're going to continue preaching this until the judgment day, okay? Thanks, Bill.
Praise Yahweh.
Okay, and good night, everybody. Praise Yahweh, and thanks for listening. Yah bless, everybody.